Okay.
So, my name again is Davide Vercelli. Some of you may know me as Uncle Jay on forums and on IRC. I'm a graduate student from Scuola Superiore di Sant'Anna in Pisa, Italy. And this year I was lucky enough to have my proposal for a Google Summer Code project accepted. And so this is what I'm going to talk about today. For the few of you who don't know what the Google Summer of Code is, it's, despite the questionable logo, it's a program from Google that encourages students to participate in open source development. So to get to know open source and how it works, and how to be part of a community, and so on. So how it works is that a student proposes an improvement over an existing open source software, and the developers of that software review the proposals, and if the proposal is accepted, over the summer the student codes the feature and gets funded by Google. And most importantly, in the end, you get a Google t-shirt. I don't have it now because I have not received it yet. That's a big problem, but you can see Martin has it because it was a mentor in this program. You can see it around. So, today I'm going to talk about what is this Lightcats algorithm. I give a simplified account, but I hope a clear account. And I'll tell you what I did in Blender and what are the integration issues that I faced and I have yet to face, and possible future directions that this project can take, maybe even as future Summer of Code projects. So, the Lightcats algorithm, let's start from this very simple concept, which is shading from a single point light. Now, when you shade from a single point light, the orange thing is the sample, the pixel you're going to shade. All the quantities involved, all the mathematical quantities involved are definite. So they are all exactly known. You take them into account. You have your own shading model. You take them into account. In a way, we don't care about how specifically you take them into account now, but you take them into account and you have a specific value, which is the exact lighting contribution from that light. So, for instance, here we have the normal of the sample, the direction of the light, and the distance of the light from the sample, and the visibility, which is a single value. So the light is visible or not visible. That's why you get hard shadows, and as you all know, overall unrealistic lighting. So let's see how things increase in complexity when you take into when you want to shade a point lit by more complex lighting. For instance, an area light, which is already a pretty simple form of complex lighting. Now, in this case, most of the quantities are not definite in the sense that they vary overall, they vary over the surface of the light. So you don't have a single distance of the light, you don't have a single direction. You have to perform an operation which mathematically is known as an integral. And it's very difficult to solve a lighting in this case analytically, so by finding a single formula that gives an exact result, especially if you take visibility into account. Because if you don't take visibility into account, for instance, you can see here we don't have shadows. This is how it's implemented in Blender. So there is a single closed formula for lighting from area light, but it doesn't take visibility into account again. So even if you use an area light, it's pretty fast to render, but you don't get shadows in this way. Because one of the way to solve this kind of problem is using a numerical approach. The most famous numerical approach in the random field is the Monte Carlo sampling, which is a way to compute approximate solutions to this kind of problem, that is integrals. And it's the direction taken by the mainstream rendering research and most commercial rendering projects. And in Blender, this is used, for instance, by ambient occlusion and environment lighting, that kind of stuff. So in this case, you can have also shadows from other lights, but it's something you add separately from the shading from the other light. So the you get the visibility is computed separately by from the shading. Okay, so let's look at a different approach to this kind of problem. That is, let's approximate this complex area light source by just placing a large number of point lights. So this is a very interesting possibility because it's very flexible. Because if you have whatever light source you have, you just need to convert it in point lights, and then you can shade it using the same system. But a big number of lights is required to have good results in this case. And the big problem you face is that the more lights you add, the more time you need to get the rendering completed. So, these guys at Cornell University published a paper in 2005 at SIGGRAPH introducing a new algorithm called the light cuts algorithm, who tried to solve this kind of problem, so handling a large number of point lights. So their objective was not to reduce the number of point lights you want to handle. This is not your objective. So your objective is to handle them in an efficient way. But the point light generation must be simple because this is one of the strength of the system. But of course, what you want to do is that you want to achieve sublinear rendering costs. What this means is that if you have k lights that render in say t time, if you double the number of lights, you want the rendering time. Of course, the rendering time increases, but it does not double. You get a less increase. So how do you achieve that? Let's look again together at this at the core idea that is behind the light algorithm. If you have two similar point lights, where similarity is defined by taking intensity, position, and direction into account if the light is directional, what if you substitute the two lights by using just one, with intensity increased accordingly? Of course, the image is different. It's not the same. So, well, this is a pretty obvious observation, but this is not the the core observation. The core observation is that if you do the difference between the two images, parts of the image are very similar, while other parts are very different. So what happens is that if we could choose at each pixel, if considering the two lights, so the accurate solution, or the single light, which is the approximate solution, but which is acceptable in that case, in that specific pixel, you would have a saving in rendering times without having two noticeable errors in the final image. What do we mean by noticeable errors? We have to take human perception into account. So human perception is sensitive to signal ratios instead than to absolute values. This is something that is known as Weber's law. So if you have a pixel intensity which is wrong by, but it's wrong by a fixed percentage with respect to the correct value, if this percentage is small enough, you shouldn't notice it. You shouldn't notice the error. Okay, so this was, of course, the core idea with a very low number of lights, but how do you actually extend this idea when you have thousands, tens of thousands of lights? How do you handle that efficiently? Because, of course, if to perform this choice, you spend a lot of time, there's not going to be any saving in rendering time in the end. And the biggest problem is, how do we know if the approximation is acceptable or not? Because we don't know the correct value, of course, because if we knew the correct value, the rendering would be already available. So lights get organized in a global light tree, which is something that you build before the rendering. It's a tree where the leaves are the actual lights, while inner nodes are representatives. So each representative light represents all the lights that are beneath it. So what happens is that at each pixel, you want to evaluate just a subset of these lights. In particular, we call this subset the light card, which explains the name of the algorithm itself. So the light card is the set of lights we actually evaluate, and in general, they are representatives and not actual lights, but it can be a mix of both. It's defined so that a path from the root to the actual light contains only a single node of the cut, so that you never consider a light twice. And so in the end, we can interpret this as having the tree as the set of all possible partitioning of lights you can have in that scene. And a single light cut is an actual partitioning. So how do we actually select this cut? So we start from the root node, and we compute, which is a light, so it's a representative light. It's a light that doesn't exist in the scene, but it's a big, very bright light that represents all the lighting from the scene. Of course, this in 99% of cases will be a very, very wrong and coarse approximation of lighting. So what you do, you compute temporary shading and check if it exceeds an error metric. We will see later how this error metric is computed. If it does, and in the case of the root node, probably it does, we exclude the node from the cut. So the nodes belonging to the cut are colored in orange in this graphical display. And we add the children of the node. And then we start again. Now we look for the node in the cut that contains, it currently contains two nodes. We choose the one that it's giving the biggest contribution to the final shading, and then we start again. Does it exceed the error metric? If it does exceed, you remove it from the cut and you add its two children, and so on. And when the brightest node in the cut does satisfy the error metric, we are done, and we have the shading from the pixel without having computed the actual shading coming from all the lights. So, of course, here the big problem is how to compute the error estimation. And the solution is actually pretty simple. You compare the approximate value that you get, that you have during the traversal of the tree, you compare it with the maximum possible value that you can get from the lights which are beneath the current node we are evaluating. So if this is under a fixed percentage of the current shading estimation, so of course that's true also for the actual value that we don't know. In this case, the approximate value is acceptable and we don't need to refine the cut. The other problem is that to compute this maximum possible value that the cluster can contribute to the shading, we have to perform some bounding which has to be both tight and cheap. Tight because if it's not tight, we are always going to go down to the actual lights. And if it's not cheap, well, of course, rendering times are not going to be short. So, the contribution of a single light has three components. A geometrical component, a material component, and a visibility component. And I'm going to explain what they're about. And we can bound them separately. For instance, to bound the geometric factor for omnidirectional lights. Omnidirectional lights have a fall off, so with distance they are they get more faint. So for each cluster we maintain a bounding box of all the lights that are beneath the representative light. And this way we can bound the minimum distance that gives us the maximum possible value for the fall-off that we can get from that cluster. Unfortunately, in Blender, we have to consider various fall-off functions. So the accurate fall-off function for light in realistic lighting should be just inverse squared, while in Blender we have also other stuff, inverse, linear, constant, and other stuff. So I had to take all this into account, which was one of the few original, let's say, contributions on my behalf to the algorithm. And so for oriented lights, which are like spotlights, but having a 180 degrees cone, we have to bound both the fall-off and the direction. So in each cluster we have to maintain not only the bounding box but also a bounding cone for all the directions. And this gives you the minimum directional attenuation that you can get from spotlights, because if you are just beneath a spotlight you get the maximum intensity of the light, but if you are like not under the normal of the spotlight you get less light. And well, for a sun there's no bounding. The other part is bounding materials, and this is a pretty difficult part. So you have to take into account the different shading functions separately, which is fairly easy for diffuse shaders, but it's way less trivial for straighter ones. What happens here is that, let's say that your cluster representative is the orange light. It will give you a fairly faint contribution because it's almost at the same, how do you say, elevation with respect to the sample. But you know the bounding box, and so potentially it could exist a light beneath that is just above the sample, and so it's giving a potentially large contribution, and you have to take this into account. So the third component would be bounding visibility, but that's pretty hard in the general case, and the original paper actually left it unbounded, and is currently unbounded also in my implementation, even though there are some tries in this respect. What happens here is that if your representative light, for instance, is not visible, you can it could be that other lights in the cluster are visible, so you cannot discard your cluster, unfortunately. But if the entire cluster is covered by an obstacle, you would like to discard it, because that would save you a lot of rendering time. And this is not so easy, unfortunately, to do. It can be handled in some specific cases, but again, I'm not doing that. And this is why, actually, when you have a lot of occlusion, rendering performance is a bit worse. So, what are the main benefits of this kind of approaches? That as you add complexity in the lighting, rendering times don't grow proportionally. Because in the end, the lights, the contribution of the single lights is going to be so small that there's a sort of stabilization of rendering times after a certain complexity in the lighting is reached. And this system exploits a particular thing that if you have a very bright light, this is going to make the evaluation of other faint, but other complex lighting, but faint and far away, for instance, useless, because you already have a very strong contribution, so you wouldn't notice the other contribution far away. So this system tends to exploit this kind of, this kind of events if they happen in a scene. And the other thing, the other interesting thing is that they unify, as I was saying before, in a single strategy, the handling of lights coming from different sources, because the algorithm itself does not know anything about the original light sources. It just knows about an enormous amount of point lights placed in space, but it doesn't care if originally it was an environment lighting, some point lights placed by the user, area lights, or even some forms of mesh lights, some forms of indirect lighting, as we will see. There's also a minor benefit, which is that the rendering times are controlled also by the error threshold that you can choose. So the 2% that we mentioned before is a good value for high quality renderings, but you can raise the error threshold and have lower quality renderings, but you can have a preview of how the final rendering is going to be. But this doesn't always work very well. So it's a bit scene dependent. This is why I say that it's a minor benefit. So okay, this was the general idea behind the LightCats algorithm. So let's see what I did in Blender. What are the supported point light sources? The actual point lights that you have in Blender, the arrow lights with even some additional feature, and environmental lighting, and most importantly, probably, instant radiosity. I'm going to detail all of them now. So the actual point lights are lamp, the sun, the spotlights, but only with a complete cone, so 180 degrees cone. They give hard single sample shadows, but this is because they are meant to be used in big numbers. And so sometimes some testers were disappointed because they placed a sun and they had overall good lighting, but the shadow from the sun was really ugly because it was single sample. So I agree this is a problem that must be dealt within the framework of LightCats. So for instance, I could substitute the sun with a number of like 60 suns, very close, fainter suns that give a sort of softer shadow, for instance. Arrow lights, they're for each arrow light, I place a number of point lights over the surface. And what's interesting here, it's a new feature with respect to the previous features available in Blender Internal, is that you can get textured arrow lights like this. So this is the lighting coming from, this is the shadowing coming from actually substituting the arrow light with a colored texture. So all of them. I don't know if you can see the effect very well from there, but anyway, it's there. And it's what a colored screen would project. And it's different from what you had before, because you can add a texture to light, but it's a completely different thing. It projects a texture on the scene. It's not the same thing. So okay, these were a couple of popular pictures when they were out on forums. So another thing I added just this week for Blender conference was that materials we emit become actual lights. So in the scene, there are no lights. The actual mesh are lighting the scene. The shading on the letters is maybe not very nice, but that's how materials with emit get rendered in Blender actually. So maybe I should change the way mesh lights are introduced in the system. But it's pretty simple because, I mean, you just have to create lights over the surface of the mesh. So it's just a matter of deciding which is the parameter that controls the placement of the lights. I did it with the emit value of the materials. I can do that how the user thinks it's better. So here's another scene. I don't know if you can see the lighting coming from the colored parts. Well, who's interested can come and see it here later, probably. It's subtle lighting. And okay, environment lighting. This is similar to what you get when you use image occlusion with reading from the sky texture. It's slightly faster. Actually, it's almost the same. And so the most important part is probably this instant radiosity thing. So instant radiosity is a technique developed by Alexander Keller, I think, which simulates indirect lighting by placing a big number, by placing point lights where direct lighting hits the scene. So for instance, here I have a light and it's hitting this table, and I place some additional virtual point lights here from the table, lighting in the other direction, so that I get lit also from the table and not only from the top. So this is an ingenious way to simulate indirect lighting. And so far, research in this field has tried hard to keep the number of virtual point lights low and still maintain the indirect lighting effect. But in this case, we don't have to care about reducing the number of virtual point lights, because we can just throw thousands and thousands of point lights, and the algorithm is going to select them adaptively per sample. It's not going to do a global selection. So for instance, here is a test scene just to give you the idea, with only direct lighting, and this is what you get with indirect lighting. Here's another scene, direct lighting, indirect lighting. Well, I don't know if you're seeing it very well, probably not. Is it visible? And oh, by the way, there's also this is a debug mode to visualize the placement of virtual point lights. So to give you the idea of how many lights we are handling here. And some guys on the forum use this thing to actually place objects in a scene. So something that has nothing to do with rendering. He just uses this and doubly blurs things in the scene. So, well, it's another usage of this, I guess. And this is Sponza rendering. The scene was set up by a user on Render Artist. So here we have a single arrow light coming from the top, and the entire place is rendered with indirect lighting. I think the aspect ratio is wrong. probably. Well, anyway, you get the idea. So it's not perfect. You can see some artifacts here and there, and the indirect lighting effect is a bit exaggerated here for debugging purposes, but you get the idea.
That's 14 minutes, right?
14
minutes.
Yeah. It takes a while. Well, it was on my laptop, so it's not a cluster rendering thing. That would be pretty worrying. So supported shaders, diffuse, all diffuse ones, only from specular, and I support some other features like sphere clamping of lamps and the bias feature and this kind of stuff. I don't know. I think many users, many testers don't even know them, that some shaders are not supported. So they get some, well, probably still they get unnoticeable errors. Recently this week I added support for baking and SSS. This is the compatibility actually with SSS as coded in Blender Internal. Okay, so let's have the bad news now. All the users hate me because of the flickering in animation. So some nice guys on Blender Rafters really lost several nights of sleep to tweak all possible parameters to avoid flickering. And there were some improvements recently, but some flickering is still there. So maybe there are still some remaining bugs on my side. I'm not claiming that the code is perfect. And there are also some limitation. Well, of course, for instance, with the instant radiosity algorithm, I'm not sure it's meant to produce like flicker-less results. Another possible problem could be, I would like to investigate this more, could be precision issues, because when you use like several thousands of lights, they are very very faint, so they are like lights with 0.0001 intensity, and Blender is not coded to take this kind of faint lights correctly into account, I guess. So I mean, there could be problems also in that respect. We have to switch to double precision, unfortunately. Could be a problem. All right, anyway. Okay, the other problem is that the rendering times actually are good, still not compelling. But here, I want to be clear on this aspect. I mean, I think the performance can be improved, but it's still a ray tracing based rendering system. So it's always going to have rendering times comparable to, for instance, ambient occlusion, not the approximate one. And I think that with complex lighting, it's way faster than what you would get with QMT and this kind of stuff. But yeah, we are still talking about minutes. Okay. But see future directions. I'll talk about later. So integration issues, user interface. I heard someone the other day complaining about messy UIs, and yes, I am guilty. So right now this is how the Lightcuts panel shows up in the Lightcuts branch. It's not the cleanest panel I've ever seen. It's not even the worst.
Like a typical
level. Typical. And most sliders actually are there for debugging purposes. So the final UI will not be this complex. We'll actually have way less parameters, I hope. Well, temporary UIs have this tendency to stick and stay forever as final UIs. So there is this risk. Okay, I agree, but I still consider it a temporary UI. Okay, so our problem is that some features of the Blender internal are plain unsupported. Mainly the unrealistic, let's say, features. For instance, I don't know if many of you know that lights can have a custom curve as falloff. Actually, many of you probably don't even know that lights have a customizable falloff because they are rarely understood to be important. But anyway, you can actually have a completely custom curve. And of course, that is, how can you bound that in the general case? So the curve could even diverge so that if you are far away from the light gets brighter. So this is something that this algorithm cannot take into account for, I mean, it's something, there's no way around it. And this is true also for other unrealistic features. Another serious problem is with node materials, again, for the generality of the feature. So how do you bound them in the general case? Again, remember, you need a cheap and tight bounding function. So this is something I have not yet coped with, and well, we'll see. Of course, node materials are the future, so this is key to support them in some way. The other problem is that, from the user point of view, is that Leica's has some sort of unintuitive performance. First of all, if you have too few lights, I mean, you don't enjoy the benefits of the algorithm. So you have to understand that it gets better the more lighting you add. So this is the exactly opposite way we are trained to think. So we want to simplify lighting to cut rendering times. Here, to make the most of rendering times, you may want to add indirect lighting, environment lighting, this kind of stuff. And you want to avoid, for the reason I mentioned before, larger footed areas. They are slow because of the relative aromatic. So the fixed percentage you are allowed to have as an error, if the pixel is completely black, the error is zero, of course. So you are obliged to go down the tree. But this is something you can cope with the, you can choose a maximum cut size, and if you choose that sufficiently large, you can sort of reduce this kind of problem. But still, it's better to avoid larger occluded areas. And one way, for instance, is to add indirect lighting or environment lighting, so that even the occluded areas are not completely black, they still receive some lighting. But this, I mean, is a benefit, should be a benefit in most cases. Again, rendering times, so this is actually repeating what I said before, but rendering times are affected more by occlusion than by lighting complexity. Finally, MATLAB, which is our UI counseling man, he says that we should have a switch that changes things only behind the curtains, so that the user just doesn't care about light cuts, he just enjoys better performance. But this is not exactly true, as we saw. And I think that you are not going to use this exactly same lighting rig if you plan to use Blender Internal without light cuts, and with respect that if you plan to use it with light cuts. For instance, the Sponza model that we saw before, well,
you are now placing only one light. If you wanted to render it with Blender Internal, well, you probably could achieve still a good result, but you had to place a lot of fake lights. And some types of, there's not an exact correspondence. For instance, the formula used by the area lights is not perfectly, at least I couldn't do that perfectly approximable by collection of point lights. So you have different intensities, you have to tweak there a bit. Unless there is a solution and I don't know it yet. So maybe if there's some automation here, you can help me out on this. So possible future directions for this project, which is still a work in progress, are, here I'm going to mention possible big extensions that could be, for instance, also possible future Summer of Code projects, if some other students wants to help me out in continuing this. So one thing is reconstruction cuts, which is the second part of the original paper of the light cuts mentioned this. It's an adaptive screen space interpolation scheme that goes with light cuts, where in this case you run the light cuts algorithm not for each pixel but every few pixels, and for the pixels in between you interpolate not the final light, the final value of the pixel, of course, which would be pretty sloppy, but you interpolate the light cuts themselves. So this is I'm not going to explain this because, well, I probably don't know it well enough myself, but it's a bit complex, but gives very, very good results and improves rendering times considerably, adds probably image smoothness, could help with the flickering problem, and still preserves edges because there's no interpolation through discontinuities. But I'm not sure if this fits well with Blender's design, in code-wise, I mean. Because till now, the code for the light cuts project is fairly isolated. I just had to change the rendering flow in a couple of points, but it was fairly isolated. While this would mean changing the something more. Last time I mentioned this to Tom in IOC, he was very, very unhappy to hear that, and he completely stopped talking to me. He ignored me for all the evening, so I think there might be some problem here. But the point is, I don't know that part of the book well enough to have my own opinion on that. But I hope to kidnap Greg or Tom today or tomorrow and force them to explain me everything in detail. There's something I learned about the Blender code base is that some parts of the code base are not documented by design, because if you can't understand them by yourself, you are not meant to touch them. So there's some good, there are some good reasons to have this policy, but I'd see if with violence I can force them to. And so another possible direction is better indirect lighting, because what we have now is actually a very quick proof of concept implementation that I just put together quickly at the end of the Summer of Code time frame in time for the final evaluation. It's not, I'm not claiming it's a good instant rigorosity implementation at all. It's very, very simple. State-of-the-art seems to be Metropolis in San Jose, but I have very bad news for all of you, because the paper, I read it again recently, explicitly mentions the possibility that animations flicker with Metropolis in San Jose. So they propose a solution for that, but it's not in the paper, so I'm not sure if you can trust that. But still, this could be another possible project. Metropolis in San Jose looks pretty hard to implement, but yeah, we'll see. Oh, and the other one is multidimensional light cuts, which was the follow-up paper from the original authors, which was presented, I think, at SIGGRAPH 2006, where they extend the same principle, that is adaptive per pixel clustering, but to other kinds of sampling, not only lights, but also temporal samplings or depth samplings. And so they are able to achieve motion blur, depth of field, subsurface scattering. And they show very high quality images and with good rendering time. So again, the more you throw at it, and the better rendering time to image quality ratio, image quality to rendering time ratio you get. So, but this is, I don't know how this could fit with the workflow and the code base of Blender. Because I mean, right now we have motion blur, depth of field, which are very integrated with the compositor, so, here you probably wouldn't have the same kind of freedom. You would have better quality results, possibly, but I don't know. So we will see what the user base and the developers think it's most appropriate to pursue in the future. And thank you for listening. And thanks. No, that was meant to be and. Thanks to Blender Foundation, of course, thanks to Google, thanks to Kent Min, which was my mentor during the Summer of Code, and thanks to all my amazing amount of testers on Kino3D, the Italian community, on Blender artists, and on Blender coders. That's it. So I would like to take the opportunity to, thank also the other 2008 Summer of Code students that did an amazing job. Nicholas Bishop, which is coding improvements to the sculpting system. Maxime Curioni, I don't know how it's pronounced, which is coding the integration with the, what's it called? Freestyle, yeah, sorry, freestyle integration. And Andre Pintovich coded the amazing shrink wrap feature, which is already in 2.48. And Ian Thompson, who coded improvements to the Python editor. And of course, thank you also for their mentors.
Design it like an option, like a render layer, but then optimize the input to say, well, only specific types of materials are allowed. That's not a problem. Because your effects, like the possibility of having screen sending light into a room, That's great. That's an option if you would like to have that. Then with render layers you can combine things and you can decompose it in the various things you solve problems.
Yeah. We have to find a way to communicate this kind of limitations through the UI.
Also.
Yeah.
And of course the two other things. I think your slides show one of the things to go really back in the open back in your slides. The diagram to explain how the light works work. When you go down, exactly.
This one,
so
yeah.
This actually illustrates why you have a speed problem with the whole concept. Because it's not a good example, but if you count the amount of lights to get to this solution, you have to do more calculations than to just do this.
No, wait, there's a detail I have skipped, which is that the representative lights are actually, so for instance, this is too short, so I have to.
Hello?
Oh.
Sorry, the one society.
I think I
Okay, so if you have two actual lights, the representative lights is actually one of these two lights, but with a different intensity. So you can reuse the calculations you do for the father for one of the two children. So this improves things a lot. It imposes further limitations, some limitations, but yeah. Yeah, of course.
Have to get halfway, otherwise it's. Yeah. And the other thing, the flickering thing is, this kind of really. I didn't read about how this. What I would call it, when you evaluate the shading to find out the bound boxes and
yeah.
Object or not. That's the problem. So if you want to do it perfect, you have to set things down between you. You have to have to say that at some moment I take an average and in animation you will always see that. I don't think you have to solve it. You not make it blur it or composite it. A lot of architects use it for nice skills. But if they complain to the bug tracker that it's flickering, then we send them to the video.
I like this approach. Yeah, there's also another problem that the perceptual foundations of this work are don't take animation into account because the human eye is more sensitive to signal variations in time with respect to variations in space. So even if the error in two consecutive frames is pretty low, but you notice it if it changes that a little bit. So that's true. So it's not meant to be suited for animation in from the beginning, but probably, for instance,
baking, perfect.
Yeah, but
baking.
Yeah, and if someone or me implements multi-dimensional light cuts, you get a quality motion blur. So even probably for small women. So in that case, with motion blur enabled, you would probably have less noticeable flickering.
Just come to the front.
Apparently, it's quite complex to find out if the scene is suited for the approach or not, like number of lights, pollution, and stuff. So is there any chance you could do a quick recalculation step which estimates with some heuristics the time, or if it's worse to use the light approach versus the dome?
That's actually. It could be possible. I have to think a bit about it. It could be possible. the number of lights is not a problem. I mean, yeah, it's not that, okay, I see what you mean, but in that case, I think that the really difficult part is to understand the occlusion thing. So, yeah, a scene, a room with an object, a small object in the middle is perfect scene, while a large light with a large obstacle and a large shadow with no lights arriving there, it's a terrible scene. Yeah, so probably there could be some sort of pre-computation step in that respect. The number of lights, I mean, it's something you have to take advantage of. So the scene with the large shadow, you know, if you know these two basic facts of the algorithm, you just add some environment lighting if it's in an environment, or you add indirect lighting if it's in a closed environment, and things get higher quality. In most cases, I guess you would prefer something happening in the black areas instead of plain black, and better rendering times. So I think that the number of lights is a problem in that respect. So it's easy to understand how to overcome that.
So like, when are we going to see this in Blender?
Yes.
Well, I can tell you not before 250, because 250 is going to be the next release. There's never going to be any other intermediate release.
But it's in the branch, right?
It's a branch. You can download. By the way, before the other conference, I updated all my documents on the wiki. So if you look for user Uncle J on the wiki, you have all documents, and there's also an explanation on how to get binaries or how to compile the branch. So you can play with it. I'm continuously keeping it synchronized with the trunk. So if you download it now, it's ready to 248A. So you can use that one. I provide binaries for Linux.